Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today, it's Eating in Appalachia. Food writers Ted and Matt Lee hired a pickup truck and started driving back roads. Initially, they were hunting for the elusive wild pawpaw, but they found a lot more, proving once again that good food happens everywhere. Well, we peek inside the cupboards of America's most famous cook as we get the story behind how Julia Child's kitchen is ending up at the Smithsonian. A novelist remembers the taste of culinary heartbreak. Joshua Wesson, our resident wine maverick, has one of the bargains in bubbly, cavas from Spain. And it's the newest convenience food. Your PB&J will never be quite the same. Then, as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's get things started with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So, Jane, Michael, where have you been lately?
We've been about 5 miles away from where we live. It's the middle of winter, and we decided to stay close to home. So we went to Newtown, Connecticut, which is a beautiful old New England town, and we found a place that is not quaint looking on the outside, but has probably some of the best Italian food and certainly the great pizza in Connecticut. It's a place called Carminuccio's.
And, Lynn, you have to understand that for Jane to say this has some of the best Italian food in Connecticut, it's like saying some of the best Italian food in Italy, because I do believe that Connecticut has terrific Italian food. And, you know, Jane and I have always thought that we know everything there is to know about Italian restaurants in Connecticut, particularly those restaurants that specialize in pizza. Well, Carminuccio's taught us something we didn't know. This was truly an extraordinary pizzeria in a state full of extraordinary pizzerias.
They have a motto, which, I think by now you know that any place with a motto, Michael and I instantly give 10 brownie points to. And Carminuccio's motto is a little slice of heaven. Now, this is wrong because it's actually a large slice of heaven. Not only is the pizza good, but the slices that you could get there are jumbo by any standards.
So is this thin crust, thick crust? What?
Extremely thin crust.
But firm, solid, brittle. I mean, it doesn't flop when you pick up a piece. I mean, it's crisp, thin crust, very Neapolitan style.
Yeah, it's not the kind of pizza that you can, you know, fold sort of like a fold in half.
Not doughy
at all. Thank you, Michael. And they do all the toppings from scratch. They actually roast their own red peppers. They marinate the mushrooms. They make their own sausage. I mean, everything is extremely labor intensive. They make their own sauce for the pizza. You can get a white pie, which is a very Connecticut thing, meaning no red sauce, or a traditional red sauce. But Carminuccio's is one of these places that is, I find, very frustrating because it's, as I said, it's probably 5 miles from where we lived, and it took somebody else to tell us it was there. And the fact that we have let this place slip over the years and not found it ourselves is a humbling and shameful admission.
But we've been trying to make up for it over the past few weeks. By eating there as often as possible. And one of the things we discovered, in addition to great pizza, is that they make stuffed Italian breads. I mean, they do make their own bread for grinders or hero sandwiches. But in addition to that, they make stuffed breads. You know, it's a bread dough that is wrapped around such things as a sausage, pepperoni, broccoli rabe, escarole, whatever they happen to have, vegetables or meat. And then you take it home, actually, and bake it. And it is just divine. It's a meal for two. And I think the price of one Italian stuffed bread is about $5.
And you just hack it in half with a big knife, and each Michael takes half and I take half, and we're in heaven.
I think there's something you've got to explain to us, though. What is a Connecticut white pie?
A Connecticut white pie is a pizza without any red sauce on it, and oftentimes without any mozzarella cheese either. In other words, it's a crust with plenty of olive oil and whatever ingredients you like. Generally, not too many ingredients because it would overwhelm the crust. Olive oil, spice, maybe a sprinkle of Parmesan or Romano cheese, perhaps some raw clams opened onto the pizza, so the clam juice kind of seeps into the bread a little bit, or roasted peppers or mushrooms. No tomato sauce and no gooey mozzarella cheese either.
Mm. It's kind of the absolute opposite of a Chicago deep dish pizza, which is all red sauce and gooey cheeses and thick doughy crust.
Now, Jane, you're not going to start blasting Chicago-style pizza, are you?
Well, yes, but we won't go.
All right, we won't
go into it.
We must understand that Chicago pizza and Connecticut pizza are two completely different food groups.
And red Connecticut pizza and white Connecticut pizza are two different food groups too.
All right, I'm glad there's peace in the family.
Yes, there is.
All is well with the world.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Bye, Larry.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Gene Michael Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. You can hear them here every week on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to our website, splendidtable.org. The Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. has a new project, Unpacking Julia Child's Kitchen. Julia has moved from her home in Cambridge, Massachusetts to California, but whoever gets her house will have to go to the Smithsonian to see the kitchen, because everything has been moved there, and I mean everything, including the walls, the cupboards, the drawers, the dish towels, the pots, the pans, everything. Julia's reassembled kitchen is going to go on display in August of 2002. We have with us the Smithsonian's curator of the exhibit, Raina Green. Raina, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So, Raina, how did you come up with the idea of moving Julia's kitchen into the Smithsonian?
Well, there are three of us who are our sister co-conspirators at the museum. In August, when we really realized Julia was going to leave her house in Cambridge and go to Santa Barbara, we all had a sort of Vulcan mind meld. oh, my God, we should go ask Julia for the kitchen, because it's absolutely the right thing for the Museum of American History. And so we did.
And how did she react?
Well, we had to sell her on it. We had to convince her that we were serious about the kitchen. We also had to really talk to her about what we really meant about taking the kitchen. And we really did mean taking the whole thing, right down to the walls. And that's always sort of shocking for people to imagine that we would do such an extreme thing, in effect, gut the kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And then we had to convince her that we really were serious about the message of the kitchen and what we could teach using her kitchen. She wanted to make sure that we weren't just after the kitchen as sort of monuments to Julia the pop icon, and it's true, we weren't just after that. So she let us have it.
Well, what were you after exactly?
Well, I was after the history of American domestic life from 1950 to the present, which is not something that museums are very good about doing. We're not very good at all about 20th century. And we really wanted to update our collections in kind of American domestic history and even technological history, because the kitchen is full of, you know, changing technologies. It's full of the sort of fusion world that America's become. So that was part of it. We really were extremely interested in documenting American women's history, and particularly professional history, work, the history of the work of women in the United States. And Julia's kitchen just embodied all of those things, in addition to which it is Julia Child's kitchen. And I mean, she is somebody who has taught America how to think about their food in the last 45 years. She's been the one who's made people pay attention. So that's the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Is it a kitchen of a fancy cook?
Absolutely not. It's not the kitchen of a fancy cook. It is not a yupped up, high tech, spectacular kitchen in that sense at all. It's a big kitchen in this old Victorian house that Julia had. Very homey, very much a kitchen for friends and family. But there's this other part to it.
The part of Julia Child, the master cook.
Yeah. And all the other people who've cooked in the kitchen with her.
That's right. I mean, almost everybody in the business has cooked with her in that kitchen. But yeah. I have a question. Does Julia Child have a junk drawer?
Oh, boy, does Julia have a junk drawer, just like you and me. Actually, Julia even has refrigerator magnets, too, so just like everybody else. Little pictures and drawings on the fridge. Yes, she has a junk drawer, and the junk drawer is just like yours and mine. It's, you know, got a ball of rubber bands and some string and plastic bottle cappers but then it has things that are really Julia Child's junk that were very moving and very sweet to find. A champagne cork that Jim Beard gave her years ago, a flashlight with no batteries in it. It probably hasn't been used for over 10 years, but the flashlight had a little Dymo label on it that says P. Child, for Julia's beloved husband, Paul, who died in 1994. And then there was a signaling mirror, a World War II signaling mirror that Julia was issued in the OSS in China or Ceylon, India, when she met Paul and when she was a file clerk in the Office of Strategic Services in World War II. It has a wonderful little braided cord to attach it to your neck. Absolutely marvelous. All that sort of, the detritus of all of our lives that rests in the kitchen and is very, very personal, very idiosyncratic, but at the same time, just the junk that all of us have.
Raina, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Raina Green is curator of the Julia Child Kitchen Exhibit at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. The completed kitchen will be on view as of Julia's 90th birthday. That's August the 17th, 2002. But you can watch the unpacking and assembly now because it's all being done in public view. You know, you can't hear about Julia's kitchen without wanting her food. So how about her wonderful leek and potato soup? She calls it primal soup. It's a typical Julia recipe. She tells you everything you need to know to master the basic technique and then shows you how to do all kinds of variations. It's from her latest book, Julia Child's Kitchen Wisdom, and you can find the recipe on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, tracking great eating in Appalachia. You are where you eat, and open lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. Some food writers ply the wilds of the Napa Valley or New York City for stories, but Matt and Ted Lee headed for a part of the country not thought of as a culinary center. They took to the back roads of Appalachia, specifically eastern Kentucky. They're contributing editors to Travel and Leisure magazine and also write for Food and Wine. Matt, Ted, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn.
So, Ted, why this part of the country?
I think that it was the pawpaw that originally got us thinking Eastern Kentucky. The pawpaw is America's largest native fruit, and we just heard people saying it was delicious. We'd known the nursery rhyme way down yonder in the pawpaw patch, and we were wondering, where can we get these?
So you got in the car and you started driving. What did you encounter? What did you run into?
Well, one of the first people we ran into was an elderly woman named Hazel Miracle, spelled Miracle, and she was our miracle. She lives just off a little highway, tucked in a hollow, and or holler, I should say, and she was peeling apples and had spent the whole larger part of the day peeling and coring these apples, Black Ben Davis variety, it was called. Very tiny little things about the size of a golf ball, and not too attractive either, sort of dark, blotchy. It looked like they had a surface mold on them, in fact. But what she was doing was she was going to dry them out and dehydrate them and keep them for a year or 6 months or as long as she needed, and then rehydrate them to make fried apple pies. And at first, the idea of, you know, dehydrating fresh, delicious apples to make an apple pie seemed absurd. But there's something about that that oxidation that goes on, I think, as we all know from sun-dried tomatoes, but also a curing. There's some chemical transformation that goes on when you cure a food product, even, you know, cured pork, as in country ham or even prosciutto.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that later on down the road with beans, that a typical Appalachian food is called shuck beans. And you string out a whole bunch of fresh beans in the end of the summer and on a simple thread and dry them out, and then chop them up in very coarsely and preserve them just in a Ziploc bag for the next couple years or so. And when you reconstitute those and make a soupy dish of beans, it's the most wonderful, delicious, and sweet and vibrant flavor. It's not dull at all, but quite amazing.
So you're saying that the preservation method of drying actually transforms the food beyond what you might imagine it being transformed?
Absolutely. This is Ted. It's incredible. We just, in the past 2 weeks, we had some shuck beans from the Best Family Farm in Berea, Kentucky, and they were about 2.5 years old. They're from, you know, a 1999 harvest, and they were just incredibly rich, meaty. We were eating with vegetarians, so there wasn't a bit of pork in them, and they just had this amazing flavor.
I was sure that there was beef bouillon cubes in it because it was such an amazing
How did people react to you being so curious about their foods?
Oh, it was funny because we always, you know, when we get to a place where we find something really fabulous, we enthuse. And, you know, for most people in Eastern Kentucky, these foods are just daily foods. And when you draw their attention to how fabulous it is, they tend to change the subject. In Maysville, Kentucky, which is actually Rosemary Clooney's hometown, we stopped in this bakery and had something called a transparent pie, which is sort of like a chess pie, just delicious, simple, rich. And we were so excited about them. And as soon as we started praising the pies, the baker said, "Have you seen the flood wall in town?"
Completely changed the subject.
Well, okay. Did you find the pawpaw?
We did, in fact. Having pasted a sort of mugshot of the pawpaw on the dashboard of the pickup truck we were driving, we had absolutely no success just finding it in the wilds. But we did get a tip from the Bests, the bean people that we had met with, that there was an agricultural experiment station, a whole sort of vegetable laboratory of pawpaws up the road in Frankfort, Kentucky. Ted corrects me. Yes, Frankfort, Kentucky, where Dr. Kirk Pomper has about 1,200 trees laid out on a grid, and he was very kind enough to show us around. And it was heaven to visit this place. We just walked the aisles of these trees, just plucking pawpaws off. We happened to be there for the 1 week that pawpaws are ripe. There are a few problems with pawpaws that make them not very commercially viable. And I think
right.
Ted,
yeah. They're very perishable. The season, the harvest season is about a week, and as soon as they're off the tree, they start to really ripen heavily and quickly. And we went down the rows with a plastic spoon, cutting off the tops of each ones, and they taste delicious. Some taste like mango, some taste like strawberry crossed with banana, some even sort of have a caramelly Madeira-like note, and we're so excited by them and the variety of the flavor that we wanted to take some with us, and we said to Dr. Pomper, well, how long will they last in our air condition, the cab of our air conditioned truck? He just looked at his watch.
So you mean hours?
Hours.
Well, they freeze actually very well, and this is, Dr. Pomper's noted that the frozen pulp is probably the future of the pawpaw. By the way, the week that we're referring to is the end of August, beginning of September, and it varies by the latitude that the pawpaw is growing in.
Okay, we'll meet you in the pawpaw patch in Kentucky next August. Take care and thanks.
Thank you, Lynn.
Thanks.
Food writers Ted and Matt Lee are contributing editors to Travel and Leisure magazine. Their article on the Appalachian Trail appeared in the March 2002 issue of Food and Wine. Novelist Patricia Volk's latest work is a memoir. It's called Stuffed, Adventures of a Restaurant Family. Needless to say, food has always figured prominently in her life, so much so that she sometimes ponders the bigger questions. For instance, should tastes be given landmark status?
Some people remember the first time they saw the Eiffel Tower. I remember the first time I had Tornado Rossini at Maxime's. A filet mignon on a slab of pâté on a tuffet of brioche soaked in sauce marchande de vin. How could cold steel compare to that? When you're traveling, the challenge isn't finding a good place to eat. It's finding the place that tastes like the place you're in. What you eat when you're there that tells you you're there. I'm talking stone crabs at Joe's in Miami, or baby backs at Flynn's Dixie Ribs. I'm talking steamers at Louis in Port Washington, fry bread in Kayenta, Arizona, the late great abalone sandwich at Nathan's on Coney Island, and soup à l'oignon at La Pommier in Layal at 3 a.m. Once you get the dish thing, you have a sense of purpose no matter where you are. During a business trip in L.A., New York got snowed in, and the group I was traveling with had to make a decision. Where would we fly that night so we could get to New York in the morning when the weather lifted? The entire Midwest was open to us. How about Wisconsin, I said. Isn't falling water there? Nobody knew. How about Columbus? We could see James Thurber's house, I tried. Nobody cared. Then I remembered Calvin Trillin's piece about Arthur Bryant's. What about Kansas City, I said. We could have ribs. The account man who could do anything made a few calls. We flew to Missouri. A limo whisked us to Arthur Bryant's. It was 10 minutes before closing. Mr. Bryant stopped sweeping and flicked the lights back on. The ribs were big, black, and crusty, the taste of Kansas City, and each of us got an Arthur Bryant mechanical pencil with a floating bull in the top. London is Welsh rarebit at the counter of the Fountain Restaurant in Fortnum and Mason. Ireland is oatmeal, rich as a nut. Sometimes the dish is what a town is famous for. Other times it's the association the food has with the place. A triple whammy is when the food, the place, and what's going on in the world all tie in together. This happened on August 4th, 1964, aboard the SS United States on a family trip. You can have anything you want at any meal, Dad explained, even if it's not on the menu. To test the waters, I ordered something I'd only seen in comics, pheasant under glass. I got pheasant under glass. Once I knew I really could have anything, I only wanted one thing, caviar, tubs of it with piles of decrusted, perfectly toasted white bread. I was on the sea, eating what tasted of the sea, and reading Hawaii, an island born from a coconut bobbing in the sea. Finally, I understood the meaning of sublime. Then the news came over the wire. Marilyn Monroe was dead. I can never eat caviar without thinking of her, or think of her without wanting caviar. Thanks to fusion cuisine, it's hard to get the pure taste of any place anymore. Where will it end? Thai Inuit? Afro shtetl? Pierogi con salsa? Besides, it doesn't do any good to get attached to a taste. Ask anyone who's ever loved Schraff's fudge. Dense, velvety, dark, and winey. Was the secret ingredient Cointreau? Coffee? Cinnamon? Schraff's fudge was the taste of New York, my favorite taste in the world. Every place I go, if there's a candy store, I stop and buy a piece of fudge. Nothing comes close. People who fall in love with a taste are asking for culinary heartbreak. I can't find Flynn's Dixie Ribs anymore either. Must have blown over in Hurricane Andrew.
Patricia Volk is author of Stuffed, Adventures of a Restaurant Family. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert who believes wine is a democratic drink, like beer, something you can enjoy with anything. He's always looking for good wines for not a lot of money. Hey, Josh, nice to have you back.
I love being back.
Josh, I want to talk about cava. Tell me everything you know about cava.
It has bubbles. It's cheap. And
that's
I have a pressing
why I
engagement with my tailor, and I have to go right now. Cava, for people who are listening who've never heard this term, it means cellar in Spanish, but it's actually a word that was adopted by the Spanish wine authorities in 1970 to describe any sparkling wine that comes from special areas of Spain that is made like champagne. And it really means cavas principally come from the region of Catalunya near Barcelona, but in fact there are about 7 or 8 places that you can make cava, but it's replacing the term champagne, which was very confusing because champagne is a place in France.
Right.
And if a Spanish wine producer making sparkling wine like champagne uses the word champagne, someone might think that in fact it's coming from France. But we're talking about wines that come strictly from Spain, that have bubbles in them, that are made like champagne, but in fact have nothing to do with the region of champagne.
Does it tend to be dry? Does it tend to be sweet?
Well, the big difference between champagne and cava is that the grapes that go into cava are different for the most part, and the wine in Spain is aged for a shorter period of time than it is in France. A champagne has to be kept aged for a minimum of a year before it can be released, whereas in Spain it's 9 months, and the longer time the wine ages, the more complex it gets.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a situation in Spain where you get wines that are sparkling, that are beautifully made, but they don't have the depth and complexity of champagne, but then they cost a third or a quarter as much, and you don't mind missing that complexity. And sometimes it's good not to have that because you're using the wine in ways where the complexity would not be a benefit.
So can I get a sweet cava or a dry cava?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because you can get cavas in every style that you can get champagne. You can get bone dry cava, you can get dry cava, you can get cavas with a little bit of sweetness, you can get cavas that are fully dessert level. And they use the same descriptors as you'd find in champagne. So a brut cava would be dry,
mm-hmm.
An extra brut would be bone dry, an extra dry cava would be a little bit sweet. And you can find full dessert ones, although it's rare to find them outside of Spain. So there's a cava for every possible style and every possible situation, and they don't cost very much. You know, the range of cavas start at about $7 or $8, and you can get them for up to maybe 20 or 25. But Cava stops where champagne starts, so it's a great place for people who love sparkling wine but don't want to spend a lot of mm-hmm. money to play.
What are some of the ones you like?
Well, I mean, there's so many good cavas out there, it's almost impossible to find a bad one. But I do have three favorites because they're so consistent and they have complexity as well as deliciousness, which is different from champagne because the grapes that go into cava, Chirello, Pareada, and Macabeo, have different flavor profiles than the grapes that go into champagne, which tend to be mostly made from Pinot Noir and Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
The least expensive cava that I find to be extraordinarily consistent is made by Segura Viudas. And they're a relatively small house near Barcelona, and they make a cava called Aria, A-R-I-A. And it sells for $9 or $10, and it's very popular. You can find it often in supermarkets. And here's an insanely good sparkling wine that if you make a bowl of popcorn and you just sit in front of the television and watch a movie, you're going to be very happy with this wine. And if you open up some caviar, you're also going to be happy with it. It can really reach out and go the distance from one side of the table to the other. And for $10, you never need an excuse to open a bottle of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There are some other wines that have a little bit more complexity. The great thing about cava, from $6, which is the least expensive one, to $20, you get exactly what you pay for. For every dollar or two that you spend, you'll get a little more complexity, a little bit more depth. There's a wine called Montserrat, M-O-N-T-S-A-R-R-A, and it sells for $11 or $12. And this wine has a little bit more richness than the Segura Viudas, and it's delicious in its own right. It also has the most fantastic label I've ever seen on a bottle of sparkling wine. It was designed by some art students in a contest, and it looks, it's so good that you'll keep the bottle afterwards and stick flowers in there. I mean, it'll be, you know... Forget all of the, you know, the Matus Rosé bottles from your college days. This is the real deal when it comes to, you know, finding a cheap vase. And there is a cava that does, in fact, rival entry-level champagnes in complexity. It's made by a tiny house, one of the smallest producers, in fact, in all of Spain for sparkly wines, called Juve y Camp, J-U-V-E, and then the letter Y, and then C-A-M-P. And it's a Gran Reserva, and it's aged for 30 months rather than 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you can imagine how toasty and wonderful and delicious it is. Mm. You know, I just served a bottle of that about 2 weeks ago to some friends at a champagne tasting, and, you know, everybody was completely blown away by the wine.
Well, Josh, you did it again. Thank you.
What did I do?
You covered the waterfront.
Oh, great. Thanks.
Joshua Wesson is creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. You can find his cava suggestions on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at the Splendid Table store. It's where you can check out some of my favorite food finds, the things I've tasted and really enjoyed. And by the way, I'm sampling some new stuff right now. It's all there on the homepage, splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for our food query. This week's question is... What is Buddha's hand? It's edible, by the way. Okay, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. Now, that number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's food question. The question was, what is the food called Buddha's hand? It's a type of citron, which is an ancient member of the citrus family. You know, candied citron for Christmas fruitcake? Well, Buddha's hand citron looks like a lemon crossed with an arthritic octopus. It's yellow, rounded at one end like the palm of your hand, and at the other end there are long, thick, contorted fingers. Now, this does not sound like a winner, but once you smell citron, you're hooked. Imagine pure Arabian Nights. Jasmine, sandalwood, lemon. This is one sexy fruit, guys. It was all over the place during the medieval and Renaissance periods. In dishes from meats to desserts, it decorated rooms, it went into perfumes, and it still does. And the Japanese and Chinese still scent rooms with it, and they also use Buddha's hands as temple offerings. Now, it used to be you couldn't get fresh citron, but now they're growing it in California. The season is from November to February. The supply is small, so you're going to have to check out specialty food shops.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Michael on the line. So, Michael, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm after some information and sources for vanilla used in savory dishes.
Uh-huh. You are a vanilla fan, I gather.
Yeah, I like doing lots of different cooking, and, you know, I've done some simple things like, you know, vanilla beurre blanc.
Uh-huh.
And that worked good, you know, like over salmon or tuna, but coming across other things, you know, where you can find cinnamon and chocolate and nutmeg used in savory dishes, but I've never found vanilla.
Uh-huh. You know, I think you ought to explain to everybody what a beurre blanc is, because I think a lot of folks may not be familiar with it.
For me, it's, you know, my knowledge of it is just basically a white wine reduction sauce with a light cream added to it.
So you boil down the white wine and
yeah,
then
and right at the end I add, you know, a little bit of vanilla bean and, you know, the seeds from the vanilla bean, and you know, I cook that in and then cook down the cream.
I see. So you're just whipping in that cream over heat, right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, I was going to suggest, when you said vanilla with savory dishes, the first thing that came to me are things like butter and cream. Very, very rich, fatty flavors tend to blossom with vanilla. And vanilla just does nicely in those flavors. But although I've never tried this, it occurs to me that wouldn't vanilla be nice with things like boiled down good stock? You know, I'm thinking meaty flavors. If you took a nice chicken broth and you simmered it down, maybe with a little bit of butter to give it a little richness, and then stirred some vanilla in toward the end, I think that would really be tasty. And you could put that over poultry, or you could put that over, you know, something. You know what that would probably be great? Imagine drizzling that over mashed potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mashed potatoes that you've mashed with butter and a little cream. So you've got that balance of the meatiness with a little bit of that nice, big, sweet flavor of the fat, the butter fat, and then you've got the vanilla.
Okay.
Something to think about. The other thing that occurred to me is vanilla with orange. It's a good combination, and I'm remembering a chef a long time ago did a lobster dish, and this means you could do it with scallops, for instance, because they have that similar quality, where he boiled down some orange juice with a little bit of orange zest, and he did it with a split vanilla bean in the pan. Now, that could really be tasty. I think that's worth a try.
Yeah, that one sounds good.
Yeah, so I said give that a shot. So think the citrus family, especially things like orange, but the orange zest for some snap. And then think about broths, meaty flavors with that vanilla.
Yeah, my thing was trying to stay away from the sweet flavor. You know, it's
you
always come across sweet vanilla.
Yeah, of course. But I think it's great. Hey, it's great you're experimenting. You know,
yeah.
This is good. So try it out. See
Thanks
what you think. Okay.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Goodbye. Give us a call at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who's up? Daryl is calling. So, Daryl, what is on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Well, Lynn, I have a tin of Turkey Red Hard Winter Wheat. These are the whole kernels.
Uh-huh.
35 pounds of this stuff. My mother gave it to me.
Is your mother a wheat farmer?
Well, we used to do that a long time ago.
Uh-huh. So how did she come by 35 pounds of the winter wheat?
Well, I'm not sure. It's one of those nice, square, tall tins.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure if it's seed stock or if it was meant for a mill. But I want to know if I can do anything with it. Should I grind it up and bake with it? Or can I put in stews like barley? Or
yeah. I mean, all of the above. Yeah, you can put it into stews. There's a whole tradition in the Mediterranean of cooking whole wheat kernels. And you boil them until they're tender. Some people like to soak them first overnight. I just drop them in lots of salted water that's boiling. Like, you know, cook it the way you would cook pasta in a lot of water.
Okay.
And it's going to take maybe 45 minutes to an hour and a half. It depends on the wheat kernel.
Okay.
But they should be nice and tender. And then add them to soups, especially any vegetable or bean soup or anything spicy, like a really spicy tomato soup. And you put in, I've got this great idea. Take the wheat, make a simple tomato soup with garlic and onion and, you know, maybe some basil and some oregano.
Yum.
But then turn it into sort of a Moroccan-style soup by adding cumin and then add this Moroccan seasoning. You can get it in cans and in tubes in specialty food stores. It's called harissa, H-A-R-I-S-A, and it's this real spicy hot chili paste.
Mm.
And then add the wheat kernels. I think that would be just sensational.
Well, so I'll give it a try.
And the other thing you should know about the wheat kernels, again, in the Mediterranean, often they're eaten as a salad base. You know, like the way you would make a potato salad?
Oh, really?
Yeah, or a marinated vegetable salad. And the other thing, in southern Italy, people boil them up and they serve them the way they would pasta. Any way you'd sauce pasta, you can sauce a wheat berry.
Wow. Do you have a book that I should read? Or?
Well, you know, I don't know if anybody who's done, there's no doubt got to be books out there about cooking with wheat berries. But I know there are some books on southern Italian food, and there's Mediterranean books. Anything by Claudia Roden, R-O-D-E-N, is probably worth looking into. Anything by Nancy Jenkins, J-E-N-K-I-N-S. She's written about a region of southern Italy where this is done. The region is called Puglia.
Okay.
So I think the idea is, too, of course you can grind it and make bread, but the berries themselves are really delicious. And it's a key is boil them until they're really tender. And then, you know, you can freeze them, too, once they're cooked in a Ziploc bag.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, and they'll keep in the fridge for a couple of days.
Yeah, I really wanted to find something to do with it other than grind it up and turn it into bread.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be like great bread, but I'd say try the boiling technique. Oh, there's one other thing.
Okay.
Cereal. The cooked wheat berries, toss them with something like cottage cheese or ricotta and some dried fruits, you know, chopped up dried apricots and some raisins, and have them in the morning for breakfast.
Oh, yummy.
Yeah, and good for you? Oh, absolutely. Healthy as all get out.
I got enough to feed an army, so.
Well, you sure do. 35 pounds of them. You're going to have a whole year's worth of cooking here.
Great.
Share them with friends. Hey, Daryl.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Daryl. Goodbye. There's this idea of taking whole grains and boiling them goes back to probably before the Romans, you know. There's another grain, and it's related to the wheats of today. It's called, in Italian, it's called farro, and in English, it's called emmer, E-M-M-E-R. And it has a sweet, nutty flavor, a lot the way a wheat berry tastes. A wheat berry, when you cook it, tastes sweet and nutty. And what you can do with it is boil it, just the way I said you could boil the wheat kernels. And in Italy, it's cooked in with soups, especially soups that have beans with them. And it's used just the way you would use pasta. It's dressed in a dozen different ways. I forgot to tell Daryl one thing. You could pre-cook your wheat berries, and you do this with farro too, and then take a risotto recipe and follow the recipe, but substitute the cooked wheat berries for the rice. They can take that extra cooking, and it's absolutely delicious. All right, I'll move away from grains now. Hey, you can reach us, 800-537-5252, and we will talk. We've got Dan calling. So, Dan, what's up?
Lynn, my girlfriend, she's kind of a Spanophile.
A Spanophile?
Yes.
This is a person who is a fan of Spanish food.
Everything Spanish.
Okay, all right.
And she really enjoys the Spanish cheese cabrales.
Oh,
cabralesa.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she had a question about how long a blue cheese can stay in the fridge. And the question sort of came up when she found mold on the cheese.
Yeah.
And but then she realized that basically it's a blue cheese, which is the cheese with mold. So she really wasn't sure how long you could keep that kind of cheese in the fridge.
I'm tempted to say the question is, which mold is showing up as the cheese ages? There's, by the way, there's a wise aleck answer to how long you can keep a blue cheese in the refrigerator.
And that is?
Until it has to be let out. Yeah, but we won't go there. I think the key here is that blue cheeses age well, but they go over the hill just like every other cheese does. So keep it wrapped.
Okay.
And when you open the wrapping, if you see any sign of brown on the surface of the cheese, which is often a sign of deterioration, or if you get a strong ammonia aroma.
That's kind of telling.
Yeah, it's telling you the cheese is not a happy thing and it's time for it to meet its demise. And it depends how long depends on the cheese. A Cabrales may keep for a week or more. It can may keep much longer. It depends on the state you bought it in. Some blue cheeses are really fragile. You know, they don't have a long life. And some of them, well, they get a bit drier, they get more intense, but they're not going to actually go over the hill.
Okay.
So you got to trust your nose, trust your eye, and the other thing is you taste it.
Okay. So I have no problem with that.
No, I don't think so. And you, a lot of times cheeses will develop mold on the surface because they're exposed to moisture or whatever, and you can scrape it off and the cheese is just swell. So I wouldn't taste the mold, but I taste the cheese on the other side.
Okay.
From the
Sounds
mold.
Good.
Okay.
Excellent.
Okay. Goodbye. I have a package in front of me. This is what I'm going to do. I can't describe what I have in front of me. The man who created this is on the phone. His name is Stuart Kennedy, and he's going to tell you what this is all about. Stuart, hello.
Hi, how are you, Lynn?
I'm good. And Stuart, I've got this package in front of me. Could you explain what I've got here?
Yes, what you have in front of you is a package of individually wrapped peanut butter slices.
Peanut butter slices. This looks like those cheeses that you have. You know, that you take one slice at a time, like Kraft singles. Stuart, you invented this?
Yes, ma'am.
Can I ask why?
Well, I tell you what, Lynn, if you have children or don't like to do dishes, you will love this product. The individually wrapped peanut butter slice is a mess-free, fast, and easy, convenient way to eat peanut butter.
Well, you know, now that I think about it, it does make some sense. How did you come about doing this?
Well, in 1997, my wife and I were over at some friends' house playing cards with Jill and Travis Wager. And actually, the idea was Jill's mother's. And she thought it would be a great way for kids to make peanut butter sandwiches very quickly without any mess. And it's portion control. And over 5,000 pounds and 432 formulations later, we determined how to take the sticky out of peanut butter.
Can you tell us that secret?
Well, I can tell you the ingredients, but I won't tell you exactly how we did it. We do have some patents pending on the product and are very, very confident that those will go through. So basically, we adjusted the fat content and added a very, very minute amount of a gum to the product.
I see. Does it come in chunky and smooth?
Well, we are working on chunky. We've had to contract with a specialty manufacturer to make smooth peanut pieces because the sharp peanut pieces poke through the plastic.
Well, that's logical. Yeah. Now the other thing is, if you could get the jelly.
Well, Lynn, if you get jelly, think about a fruit roll-up. Because we've tried jelly, you know, a good sandwich has got to have squish, doesn't it? I mean, if peanut butter is one thing because it's not as liquidy or as runny, and so we were able to maintain the flavor and the texture and the mouthfeel of peanut butter. And with jelly, we worked on it, and what we came up with was a fruit roll-up. And we just figured that people liked the squish.
Does it still stick to the roof of your mouth?
If you get two slices, it does. For the big-time peanut butter fans.
Well, Stuart, thank you for this contribution to the children of America.
Well, thank you, Lynn.
Stuart Kennedy is the creator of PB Slices. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us at any time. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this observation from Alexander Fleming, the man who discovered penicillin. He said, "If penicillin can cure those who are ill, Spanish sherry can bring the dead back to life." To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of NPR, St. Paul, Minnesota 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And check out The Splendid Table store while you're there. You can find it right there on our homepage. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lukey and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.